This episode is brought to you by my friends at SipTequila.com. It's already October, which means it's almost December. Have you joined the Sip Tequila mailing list? Sign up for exclusive deals and never miss a new release. That's SipTequila.com. Premium tequilas shipped direct to your door. Terroir, a concept that goes back centuries, where French winemakers believed that every piece of ground is unique and based upon its soil, flora, and altitude will produce a wine that is unique to all other wines. But this concept isn't just for wine. Terroir plays an important role in tequila. Each field where agaves grow will have their own characteristics based on their microclimate. My guest today recently launched a brand where terroir is front and center. We're going to hear their story and taste their incredible tequila on this episode of the Agave Social Club Podcast, hosted by me, Doug Price. Welcome to the show. This is the Agave Social Club Podcast. I'm your host, Doug Price. My guest today is no stranger to high-quality spirits. I'm here with Brandon Cummins, the Director of Education for Altamar Brands, as they recently launched their latest project, Lagrimas del Valle. Brandon, welcome to the show, and thanks for being here.
Thanks, Doug. Stoked to be here, man.
Brandon, you have a background in journalism and digital media, and you spent many of your years behind the bar in helping others create award-winning cocktail and bar programs. It seems that educating and helping others is a natural fit for you, as you do so much of that for Altamar Brands. Before we get into Lagrimas, tell me a little bit about your background and what eventually led you to Altamar Brands.
Well, if we go in the Wayback Machine and I try to dredge up the stories of my childhood, honestly, it all begins. I worked in my dad's bars and restaurants. My dad was a serial restaurateur for a number of years, and his longest standing restaurant was open for 47 years in Topeka, Kansas. And so, like, I grew up, you know, sleeping in the booths, writing up the specials cards, you know, really just like very much in food and beverage. And so hospitality has always been kind of deeply oriented in my life, you know, and it's like we had guests, not customers, right? Like, so There's just that ethos and how you think about things that I think permeates through a lot of that. So grew up in my dad's restaurants, and then, you know, off I go to college, and I swear the last thing I ever want to do is be involved in food and beverage. And so, you know, I'm getting my degree in journalism and mass communications because I love photography, I love storytelling. But, you know, I could use a little bit of side cash. And so I end up running a wine bar out there because I was like, well, you know, I never really learned or understood wine. So that bar was called Four Olives Wine Bar, and it was in Manhattan, Kansas. I was going to Kansas State University at the time. And they really instilled a strong mentality of you need to know not just what the thing is, but why the thing is, right? So where is it coming from? What's the story behind the wine? How are you going to effectively pair that with, you know, your cheeses, your meats, your whatever you've got on the menu, you know, and how are you going to elevate your guest experience through the mechanism of food and beverage? You know, they instilled that in me. And honestly, I studied harder for those tests than I did for anything I studied in college. No offense to any of my professors. But honestly, I cared a lot about just like understanding, like, why do these wines taste the way that they do? And that carried through to today. Move on from there, bartended my way there, graduated into the recession of 2007. And so couldn't find really a day job to save my life. And so turned back to bartending. And we had tried to institute a craft cocktail program, you know, in the kind of early 2000s in Manhattan. And so when I moved up to Kansas City, kind of sought out the next closest program and got involved with a bar and restaurant here that opened called Manifesto. Unfortunately, Manifesto did not survive the pandemic. But through that meant many more mentors in the industry helped to start a cocktail festival here in the Kansas City area. And one of my major mentors is a gentleman named Doug Frost. And Doug is one of only four people in the world to hold both a Master of Wine and a Master Sommelier. To have both distinctions. And so Doug definitely championed education and explaining things in such a way that hopefully it's easy to understand. So like making really complex concepts really simple. So that led me down the pathway of getting introduced to the Tequila Interchange Project, getting to work with David Sudo. And I was actually the webmaster for TIP for a while and got to go down on a Tequila Interchange Project trip. And that, you know, introduced me to Tequila Ocho, started obsessing about Tequila Ocho, which was not yet available in Kansas or Missouri. So I reached out to Altamar Brands, the importer, in hopes of, hey, guys, like, we need more quality agave here in the Kansas City area. And the story goes that I ended up asking so many questions about the brand that had not yet been asked that, you know, they asked me if I would come on and start writing some of the materials and helping with development of the brand and education of it. So here we are today. That's Brandon's path to Altamar, which is kind of a big mess, but that's kind of where it sits.
And Altamar Brands, you know, pretty impressive portfolio of high quality spirits. This was founded by W.L. Lyons Brown III. It's a powerful name.
It's easy. Yeah, it's a very epic name.
Why was Altamar Brands, why was it created? I know you weren't there at the beginning, but why did that come about?
So Mr. William Lee Lyons Brown III, he is a Brown, formerly a Brown foreman. Okay. So if you consider the generational knowledge that comes from, you know, he's the sixth generation of his family there. His father helped develop Woodford Reserve. His great-grandfather is responsible for Old Forester, and obviously his family is also responsible, purchased Jack Daniels from the Motlow family generations ago. And so, you know, the story goes that he kind of got a little fed up with corporate life, you know, and the story that, as he likes to tell it, is he was the guy at the end of the big conference table making all these decisions, but there were people boots on the ground that were had really good insights that, you know, frankly, in a big corporation, you just weren't able to entertain.
Yeah.
And he said, I wanted to get away from that. I wanted to engage with spirits that were deep in substance and sticky in terroir. And that's kind of why he founded Altamar Brands. And so we joke that every spirit in the portfolio stands on what we call the three-legged stool, which is essentially distillate, distiller, and home place. Or as I like to say, it's person, place, and process. And, you know, every brand out there could argue that they've got person, place, and process.
Yeah.
But it's how we define those things that ultimately kind of drives why we do what we do, which is essentially the person, the distiller has to be multi-generational and deeply tied to their category, right? So in every product that we've got in our portfolio, it is somebody who is multi-generational or has done significant work in that category. When it comes to place, like inextricably tied to terroir. So I use our gin actually as an example because like the explosion of craft distilleries in the United States, you can get gin made just about anywhere, but our gin is made in Sweden because of the water source that we're using for cutting it. And because it is a pure Arctic source, we don't necessarily have to reverse RO filter it. We don't have to redistill it. We can actually keep all the mineral compound in the water itself, which then impacts the flavor of the end spirit significantly. So inextricably tied to terroir, the thing could not be made anywhere else. Then lastly is process. And under process, I've actually earned two nicknames. One is the chief sniffer and taster.
Okay.
So before we import anything, it's now sent to me. I conduct blind tasting panels against, you know, what I consider gold standards for that category of spirit. And if it winds up in the top three in the blinds, then we'll actually consider it. However, the other title I've also been given is the troll under the bridge, because I've rejected so many brands, either from the tasting process or from the next step, which is a look at additives, a look at marketing, a look at, you know, what are the cultural sustainability standards? What are the environmental sustainability standards that are practiced at the distillery itself? And so process is so much more than just the liquid in the bottle. But, you know, ultimately, the architecture of what we try to do is built upon that three-legged stool and is built upon, if we do nothing else but talk about these three things, then that's all we need to ever talk about. Marketing spin should never exist. There is nothing other than just the facts, because frankly, that's the story that needs to be told anyways.
And look, you guys have, you know, there's a portfolio of other spirits. We're here to talk about tequila, but you have other spirits. Talk to me a little bit about that process. Are these usually brands that might already be in existence and you go, does it make sense for them to come be a part of us? Or is this something that you're partnering? And like we're seeing here with Lagrimas, this was a new brand that you guys helped bring to the market. But talk to me a little bit about that process on how you guys, you know, whether that's a whiskey or a gin or a tequila, how does that play out for you guys to go, hey, this makes sense for Altamar Brands? I mean, I get what you're saying with, you know, why it fits, but are some of these already in existence? Or are they pretty much all ones that you're partnering with and you're starting from scratch?
Now, many of these brands that we have in the portfolio today, many of them were already in existence.
Okay.
So, you know, we've been extremely fortunate to kind of grow with Foursquare Rum Distillery in Barbados, for example, and they've been named Rum Producer of the Year 8 out of the last 8 years and 4 out of the last 6 years by two of the largest global competitions that are judged essentially by distillers and blenders of the category. So truly being judged by your peers. It's not, you know, like I can buy a gold medal kind of situation.
Yeah.
But, you know, that was they had a brand. Well, not even necessarily a brand. They had a concept that they wanted to launch. and we got into talks with them early on, and so we kind of got to grow with them. And since then, we've now been able to develop new brands alongside them. They are more an instance where we are just kind of, we are fortunate enough to get to be the importer, and we do get to have our say a bit, but it's not the same as like, we're Lagrimas, this is a partnership. It's a differently developed product. Another example is Kubler Absinthe, right? So Kubler Absinthe has been in existence for 4 generations, and we do nothing to it. So that is simply nothing more than, here's a beautiful product that we just want to bring to the U.S. that we think is, you know, an interesting product that has a very interesting, rich story to be told. You know, and then there's projects like Lagrimas, which are very much, we see an opportunity in the world of super premium tequila, and especially in agave spirits, where it's, there is more of a story to be told, and no one's telling that side of the story yet. And so a conversation was had about, is there something relevant to be said here? Do we think that there's more to explore? You know, and fortunately, Chava and his family were game for it. So that's that's why we're here.
Yeah, I think, you know, tequila shares an incredible story. Yeah, you know, I've been trying to tell that story for a few years now. And you guys, you know, like we said, you recently launched Lagrimas del Valle, Tears of the Valley. There's definitely a story here, and quality, some of the best of the best. How did this come to be? And, you know, you guys are at 1123 Cask Queen Distillery. You just mentioned Chava. I mean, there's very few that are making tequila like Chava is. So what was that process like? Were you looking at other places? Did he just happen to say yes? And you were like, what? So tell me a little bit about how this started.
I mean, so it was a little bit of everything. You know, so we were the original importer for Corralejo Tequila years and years and years ago.
Okay.
And then Corralejo was acquired. And shortly thereafter, Lyons was invited to go down to basically help with the launch of Tequila Ocho alongside Tomas Estes and Carlos Camarena. And so we were the original importer with Ocho as well. And then, of course, similar story, Ocho was acquired. And so when that happened, Lyons turned to me, you know, having known a lot of my background with Tip and just obviously being an agave geek. He said, Brandon, if there was anyone in the world of tequila right now, you know, we've always been in super premium. We want to still be in it. If there was anyone that you could work with right now, who would it be? Whether they have a product in the market or not. And I said, honestly, Cask Queen. Like, just because...
Yeah.
Everything that the Rosales family was doing as far as, you know, the looking at like Siembra Valle Sansa Straw, looking at Cask Queen Tahona and Plata 48, like the level of flavor that they were developing across all of these different products and how different it was, right? Everyone kind of stands on their own. And then looking at the fact that they were like, you know, revitalizing these ancestral production methods, it was just really intriguing. And so Lyons turned to me and he was like, okay, cool. Well, have you reached out to him? I was like, what do you mean? Have I reached out to him? Like, I follow Chava on Instagram. Like,
did you call him?
You know, I'm just, yeah, right. It's just like, hey, man, how's it going? Like, do you want to make some tequila together?
Yeah.
No, so legitimately, I messaged him. I sent him a DM on Instagram. And I just said, hey, man, hey, Salvador. I didn't even call him Chava at that point because, like, you know, we weren't at that level of our relationship. I was just like, hey, man, here's my background. Here's what we've done. Would you ever be interested in collaborating on a project if there was one that seemed interesting? And his response was, absolutely, man, I'd love to. But, you know, let's next time you're in Mexico or next time you're in Guadalajara, let's grab dinner together. And I said, great, I'll be there in 3 days. And I booked a flight, right?
Like, yeah.
So it's like, I will be there as soon as I possibly can. And we sat down, we had dinner at Alcalde in Guadalajara, which is still like one of my most favorite, most memorable meals I've had in a long time. You know, we sat down and we're having this conversation and it's all well and good. And I'm like, Chava, like, I've been a huge fan of your products for a number of years. You know, David Sudor is a huge mentor of mine. So I love everything you've done with Siembra Valles. I love, you know, the Cask Queen standard bottling. I'm basically geeking out, right?
Yeah.
For anyone that has met Chava, he's like genuinely like a gregarious kind of friendly guy and like kind of outgoing. And, you know, the conversation was very much in that order. And then all of a sudden he just became very serious. And he was just like, look, if we are going to work together, I need to understand what you believe about tequila, what you actually believe about these things. You know, how are you going to market it? What do you believe about aguacantes?
Yeah.
What are your thoughts on celebrities? How are you going to educate people about it? How are we going to take this into the market? You know, and at the end of dinner, he said, okay, he's like, well, you know, admittedly, we're not doing a lot of contract work and we're trying to wind a lot of it down. So if we are going to take on a project, it's going to be as a family. He's like, so I need to take this back to my family, discuss it with my father and my brother and my sister. And if we're going to do it, then we'll follow up from there. Fortunately, everyone was really into it. And to be honest, it came together extremely fast. Like the interest was there. And, you know, we kind of explored the idea of it wasn't if somebody was going to explore terroir again.
Yeah.
It was when. And so how could we do it in a way where it still had respect to Ocho, what Carlos and Tomas created there, and what Ocho was, you know, and be different, but allow us to kind of further explore the concept of terroir. And so, you know, we analyzed multiple different production methods. When I first arrived at the distillery, having discussed this concept with Chava and his family, they had over 14 different samples prepared that were all different blends of, you know, roller mill fermented in stainless, roller mill fermented in concrete.
Yeah, their distillery has all those tools to give you. I mean, that's why they can produce the amount of brands they're producing, and they don't all taste the same.
Exactly. And so we went through and we tasted through all of these different, you know, production methodologies and then different blends of them, you know, 70-30 versus 60-40 versus 80-20, well water versus rainwater versus RO filtered water, you know, for proofing. And then we dialed into the actual proof point itself, you know, but at the end of the day, the discussion was Ocho was always estate grown. It's always from Carlos and his family's estates.
Yeah.
What if we were to explore the full DO for tequila? So not just the Rosales family's estates, but let's actually explore ranches from all over the DO, right?
Okay.
So thus far, we've harvested two from Amatitan, nearby Amatitan, and then we've harvested a third that's near Tulchitlan. So all three coming from Jalisco. But the plan is to expand to Michoacán, to Nayarit, as the quality of agave and timing allows.
But all from same, all going to be single estate, all from that singular field that you guys are part, and you guys are partnering, you're going and finding, you know, and we're going to get into these because you did just launch. I mean, these are vintages. These are, you know, each one is very special as we talk about terroir, but you know, how are you finding those estates, those farmers, are those ones that, I mean, they're not all Chavas. They're not, you guys don't own them, but you're partnering and making sure, hey, this is single estate and this is what we want to showcase.
Yes. So. And I will say, and you know, if you'll allow me a point of correction, I try to avoid the word estate.
Okay.
Because coming from the wine world, an estate-grown vineyard is one that is owned by the family that's producing it.
Gotcha.
Whereas, okay, since we are purchasing these, in many cases, since they're not the Rosales family's estates, they are ranchos or fields.
Okay.
Right? So that's why I'll say rancho único or a single ranch or a single field. So, and again, that's me being a nitpicker.
Yeah. No, yeah. Educate me. Yeah.
Cool. So it all starts with Chava's father, right? Chava Sr. And essentially, he just says when he's got something that is high enough quality and ready and different enough. And so it's full transparency, 100% trust that he is going to go out and select some really impeccable agave, right? And so, for example, the first field, Palo Verde, I mean, the average agave bricks were 35%, right? Which is ridiculous. The second, which is El Chiqueño, the average were at 32%. And then the third, which is not yet released but is distilled, is called El Sabino. And they were at average of 40%, 40% bricks, which I've never encountered agave that high in my career. So I'm ecstatic to get to try that. I haven't tasted it yet, but.
And then was Chava, was that the only, and like you DM'd him, he said, hey, let's have dinner. And this was the process, or was there anybody in between that you guys were looking at? Or did you say, hey, we got one shot, let's just go for it. And he said, yes. And the rest is history.
It was the one and done, man. It was literally, he responded to my DM. We went and had dinner together. Turns out we like a lot of the same music. I mean, it was just, there was a lot of just kismet, right? There was just a lot of like really comfortable feelings with it. And ultimately, it just came together very quickly. And, you know, of course, Lyons got involved. The lawyers got involved. Everybody made sure like contracts were all like, you know, T's and I's and everything was good. But yeah, it was the first, and we were just beyond belief that they were down for it and that they were cool with doing it how we were kind of proposing. And ultimately, we defer to them where their expertise obviously is best because, duh, like you don't have that reputation for no reason. So,
you know, the first, I keep calling them, you know, lots or vintages, it came out past year and people really have been going crazy. I mean, I posted a photo on Instagram last night and people were messaging me going, I'm in this state, where can I find this? How can I get my hands on this? So this is exciting. And every step of the way, there is a story to tell. And I really love what you guys are doing here. Let's go ahead and get into the production process of this. Again, I know you talked about, you guys tried different blends and to, you know, you really leaned on Chava and the family to go, hey, but you guys have the background to be able to taste and just the fact that there is a correlation to Ocho in the background to see for them them single estate for you guys to go, hey, let's continue this conversation with terroir. You know, like I said, Chava, this is NOM 1123, the Casqueen Distillery. This is one of the best. I mean, I personally think Chava is making some of the best tequila around. And I honestly think he's going to lead that next generation into amazing tequila. So, I mean, for him to see what you guys are doing to go, yeah, let's go ahead and be a part of this. Go ahead, talk me through, because you did launch the Palo Verde. This was 2022 Palo Verde, a Blanco and a Reposado. Talk to me about this entire process. You know, when we're talking about terroir, this doesn't start at the distillery. This starts in the field. And I mean, I've heard guys that I highly respect go, maturation, even in barrels, starts in the field. You know, like it, you don't get where we end up in the barrels until we understand what's happening in the field. So talk to me a little bit about that first run that you guys were going, okay, we're going to start here with Palo Verde and walk me through, you know, you've got a Blanco and a Reposado and then I'm going to taste some of it, but talk to me about that process.
Again, this was 100% trust in Chava and his family, and especially his father. So his father is who selected Palo Verde. And so the discussion was, you know, as we are kind of trying to find these fields, we want to find what we believe are going to be the most distinguishing characteristics that will ideally make them taste different, right? So what is it interplanted with? What is the soil content? What are the bricks level? What is the elevation? You know, and then also looking at microclimates. You know, so this first one, we knew that coming out of the gate, we had to get something that was going to be extremely pleasant, right? I mean, like, you want pleasing, but you also want complexity.
Yeah.
And so, you know, we went high bricks content, big sugary character, good classic agave kind of tones to it. And it's coming from an area known as the Barrancas. And these are kind of like these cliff sides that are near Amatitan. And the Barrancas have these interplantings of both mango as well as ciruela. And ciruela is like this heirloom native varietal of plum. And so you can imagine that while the agave is sitting there, the mangoes, the plum, all of this is kind of creating this interchange. And this was one of the original discussions that we had early on. You know, I was kind of waxing poetic about one of my favorite estates from Tequila Ocho was Los Mangos. And it was one of these fields that had all of these mango trees interplanted with it. Now, whether or not that influenced Chava's father in like going to seek these out, you know, I don't know. But I mean, at the end of the day, what we came away with is still, in my opinion, this kind of very big, fruity, melon-driven, kind of still tropical yet mineral. And then there's all the grassy tones because it's still the valley, right? So we're still getting that like really core valley agave character, which is, in my opinion, more grass and mineral. The irony, and just I'll get into the production process here in a second, but the irony here is that the second ranch, El Chiqueño, is actually right next to Palo Verde. And this was also done somewhat on purpose because here you've got two fields sitting almost next to one another. Almost everything is identical. The only difference is one has more shade coverage than the other.
Okay,
so El Chiqueño has slightly more shade coverage, and you'll notice that the agaves ended up being about 32% bricks. How that translates to the end spirit, like this is, you know, I always joke that this is the bullshit test, right? The two side by side, and, you know, pardon me, there's definitely going to be some language in this episode. okay. So I don't know if that's an editing thing for you or what.
Disclosure, thank you.
Yeah. Yep. Yeah, I worked back of house a number of years, so like the back of house
comes out
pretty often. Okay. Yeah. But no, you know, so it was like the bullshit test of these two sits side by side. Does terroir actually exist in the agave? Here's the best possible litmus test for it, you know. And I'll let you comment on it because I know you also have them. And ideally you can probably taste them side by side. From there it was, okay, well, how are we going, what are we going to utilize for the production process? And you know, we had already kind of determined that up to this point, which was we're utilizing 70% roller mill fermented in stainless steel, no bagasso, distilled.
Okay.
Blended with 30% Tohono crushed, fermented in wood, open air with bagasso, distilled.
Okay.
Right. So each is distilled separate and then blended post distillation.
And he does that. He likes to do that. And we saw 11 bricks as he was going different bricks levels, blending all the way through distillation, blending them together. You said that you had about 14 or so samples. I'm sure they're just playing off different numbers. Do you remember, I mean, as the team was kind of tasting through those, as you were the chief sniffer and taster and troll under the bridge. Yep. What was that? What was that like? And do you remember kind of picking out going, oh man, this one's different than this. And cause you, I mean, Tohono really does have its own flavor to it. That minerality as it's crushing those agaves, same with Roller Mill and to how they're doing fermentation. But were any of those ones that stuck out more than others and collaboratively you all came together and said, this is it.
As far as what the experience was like first, like, it was a total agavegasm, man. I mean, like, it was just the most, like, oh my gosh, I'm geeking out so hard right now. But no, I mean, the standout, a distinct standout was the Madeira, right? And, like, you know, I know there's everyone's obsessed with G4 Madeira right now, as am I, because the stuff is gorgeous, and Felipe's, you know, a mad scientist and genius. But I mean, honestly, the sample that was Tohono crushed fermented in wood, and even tasting Roller Mill crushed fermented in wood, I mean, like, the impact of the wood fermentation tanks was substantial. And then, you know, bagasso in or bagasso out was also pretty substantial. You know, I will say, like, the core, the square bottle that is fermented in the concrete also has, like, that really unique kind of mineral component to it. So again, it's more of just like cataloging it all in an indices of flavor. But the standout for me by far was that Madeira. And it was just how much of that with the, like, stainless steel Roller Mill component, because the stainless steel and Roller Mill wound up being like this big kind of bright kind of agave character. And so it was this blend between, like, this big weighty, muscly, fermenty, woody thing with, like, this bright kind of bright acidic fruit forward bit. And so that's a 70-30 split is kind of where we landed on that. And then the other big geek out was, again, then the proof point, because I want to say we tasted through about 11 different proof points. So once we figured out the blend and the percentages, we then tweak proof point. So there's not a single brand or SKU in our entire portfolio that sits at 80 proof. And that's because I'm a stickler for every distillate has a unique proof where it, like, best showcases flavor of the raw material in concert with, like, ethanol and, you know, all of that together. And so we tasted through and we zeroed in on this blend 70-30 really, like, did best between 46% to 48%. Like, we went all the way up to still strength, right? We tasted blind all the way up to still strength, but, like, 45, 46, 47, 48 was, like, this sweet spot. And so we took back samples. I took back 3 samples here to the United States, and they kept 3 samples in Mexico, 46, 47, and 48. The U.S. preferred the 47%, but Mexico preferred the 46. And so this was the, like, you know, we're going to give it to those guys, and, like, I'm going to listen to Chava. And, like, we had a whole conversation, and I was like, yeah, I mean, like, all the bartenders I've tasted with up here really love the 47. He's like, man, everybody I'm tasting with down here loves the 46. And I was like, okay, man, we're going with you because, frankly, I trust you more on this than that. You know, I mean, I know my buddies and I know their palates, but, like, at the end of the day, it's shared ownership, right? Like, the Rosales family is in it, and, like, I want it to be just as enjoyable for them as it is for all my agave geeky buddies up here too. So,
and I mean, look, to launch a brand at 46, I mean, 46 is, I mean, I love to see that higher ABV. We just get a lot more flavor there as we're not proofing down as much. But when you're launching a brand, you know, and you're trying to hit a mass market that, you know, to somebody like myself or other tequila aficionados, they go, yeah, give me that higher proof. But to just the everyday casual tequila drinker, you know, it might be aggressive. And one, this is not aggressive, but it is a bold move for you guys to go, hey, we're coming out. I mean, the Cascoin Plata is 48. I mean, it's, you know, I mean, for you guys to come out with a higher proof, it is pretty incredible, especially as we get, you know, that Reposado and just so much flavor there. I've got the Blanco. This is the 2022 Palo Verde Blanco. This is, you know, to think that this is, you're not going to find this again. This is, you know, probably limited batches because once those agaves are gone, I mean, that field's been harvested. It's not as if you're going next door and grabbing more agaves. You're going, hey, this is all that we get from it. But to know to be sipping on this, you may not find this ever again, but this is, I mean, there's a sweetness here. That agave, that Brix level, I mean, man, a thick mouth feel. We get a little briny, a little pepper here. We get some pepper with that valley there. But, you know, like I said before, Chava continues to prove why so many people want to partner with him for tequilas and why I don't know if he's had a misstep at all. I mean, I'm sure throughout everyone's journey, I'm sure there's some, like, I don't know if I should have done that. And I know other distilleries that are making more than, you know, 5 or 6 brands, but he's just hitting home run after home run. And he's done that here with your brand. I mean, a really great Blanco here. When you first had it and it was done, it's bottled, and you took it back to your team. What was that feeling like?
It was like, oh my God, you guys, this is genuinely one of the best tequilas I've ever had. You know, and I mean, Lyons in particular, he was like, Brando, that's a really big statement, especially coming from you. He's like, you know, he's like, I consider you one of the most critical palates in the world of tequila. He's like, you're saying it's better than, you know, we listed off 5-6 other brands, and it's like, I am saying it's better than that. And he's like, holy crap. So he didn't say holy crap, but you know, it's just one of those like, so we've got a winner here. I was like, yeah, it's unreal. Like, you know, and just getting to explore that with everybody, it's been one of those. It's awesome to have a tequila in the portfolio again that, like, the moment people taste it, they immediately are just like, holy crap, I've never had tequila like this before. You know, I mean, we still do, it's on our business cards, but, you know, we are kind of like, one of our company slogans was, we build brands that change perception, right? And it's like, for that idea of like, I've never had a tequila like this before, I mean, that's the experience that I'm hoping more people get to have when they're tasting this for the first time.
With these single ranches, roughly, do you know how many liters, bottles, cases is each one roughly going to yield?
Well, so the first two, both Palo Verde and El Chiqueño, were almost equivalent in size. They ended up yielding about 6,000 bottles of the Plata and about 3,000 bottles of the Reposado. So not terribly large. Now, the third, which is the El Sabino, sitting at freaking 40%, ended up yielding almost 18,000 bottles, it's anticipated 18,000 bottles of the Blanco. So we're going to have to see where it actually nets out at production, but that's the estimate right now. So you know, I was joking in the early days. It's like, so, you know, if we get 600 bottles or 6,000 bottles, like, great, that's just what it is, right? And then you don't see that same field again, maybe for another 5, 6, 7, 8 years or ever, because you never know. Because again, it's not their field. So who knows if it's going to exist again.
And then you've got, so that Blanco, delicious. And then you did put some, like you said, you put some in barrels, not as much in those barrels, but I'm assuming that this is American oak and these barrels, what time frame, how long is it going here? And was this another thing that you guys played with and said, hey, let's try it at 3 months, let's try it at 6, let's try it at 8?
So there's a few things that happened here. Number one, like, full disclosure, I work as the blender or director of barrel projects for High and Wicked for our whiskeys.
Okay.
And so a large part of what I do day to day is taste through a number, hundreds of barrels, different floors, different areas in the rick house, trying to analyze what's happening there. And I'm always obviously tasting all new American oak. I feel pretty comfortable with, I have an understanding of what oak is going to impart to a spirit and how that's going to do so in different temperatures and climates, etc. The other thing was coming from Ocho, and really listening to Carlos's philosophy of, you know, he was trying to age the minimum amount of time for that expression.
Yeah.
And then also utilizing these very well-seasoned barrels so that there's not a ton of barrel impact. It was kind of that same conversation of, perhaps, since the concept is terroir, we should adopt a similar philosophy in our maturation.
Really showcase the agave.
Yeah. And so we found some barrels that they have been using for the last 20 years. And that's what we went into. And so we filled those up. And so, yes, it is all ex bourbon. It's American oak, but, you know, extremely well seasoned with tequila. And we tasted it 2 months, you know, so right at the minimum. And Chava said, you know what? I think it's ready. I think it's ready to go. And I said, Chava, give it one more month. Just give it one more month and taste it for me. Then if you don't like it, the next ranch will go back to 2 months and that will be the standard moving forward. We got to 3 months and he's like, I don't like reposados much. I love this. And so we basically said, okay, we're not waiting to 4 months and we're going to pull it now, you know, and that then has become the production standard, right? So now the only variable that is ever going to change with Lagrimas is going to be the ranch. Everything else is kind of set in stone. You know, we've had a lot of people approach us about like, oh, well, will you do an añejo? Will you have an extra añejo? And I mean, right now, the answer is no. We've got enough to make some Plata and some Reposado. And like, you know, we want to make sure that we're doing that correctly for a while first and that we really get out there with that. And maybe we'll explore it to the future. But for the time being, no.
This Repo, I mean, the color, I mean, it makes sense. I mean, for old barrels, for, you know, not a ton of time in the barrels, again, that we've put so much emphasis on these fields. Why are we going to try to mask that with the barrel? Beautiful color here, the flavor. And I get and that agave is still there, but I get a little sweetness. I mean, some cinnamon starts to come through, light hints of vanilla start to come through. And, yeah, and there's just a medley of flavor that, you know, Chava's been able to pull together as you're helping out with blending and going, hey, this is where we want to live. This is an incredible reposado. And at 46, it's not too hot, very well balanced. You know, I would sip on this, both of these. I know people like to make cocktails. That's cool. I love cocktails. But both of these, I would love to just sip on neat room temperature, just because there's so much going on, so much complexity. And this reposado, I mean, right out the gate for you guys, repos are hard. Repos are hard to balance. It's a really incredible reposado. Congrats with this repo.
Thanks, man. I have to say that is the dangerous part of Lagrimas for me, is that, and it's pretty consistent. I end up drinking it. It's not just sipping. I'm just like, man, this stuff is so good. And I end up, next thing I know, it's like, man, there's an extra hole in this bottle. I don't know what's going on. It's leaking out somewhere.
Yeah. But. And then as you mentioned, you guys have released the next lot or next vintage. And this is also 2022. So is that year when it was harvested, when it was finished? Or talk to me a little bit about that as we go to El Chiqueño next door, and we're going to do a little side by side, but talk to me about the year and what that indicates.
Yeah. So the year is always the year of harvest. And so, you know, because we have the resting period for Reposado, and because we've tried to release the Plata and the Reposado side by side, you know, we may very well have multiple ranches in a single year. Right. And
yes,
because the agaves for El Chiqueño were actually harvested at the very end of 2022, you know, and it's like, so we wanted to at least be respectful of the fact that we knew they were coming out of the ground in December. So it's like it bears the 2022 mark rather than 23, even though the spirit won't be finished and bottled and ready to go until 2020. Again, similar selection process, right? We fully trust the Rosales family on this. So it's like, go find another field, you know. And again, it just so happened that they were like, well, we have the opportunity basically to get one that is pretty much next door to Palo Verde, still in Amatitan, still the same interplantings, but more shade coverage, less direct sunlight, you know, and we'll just see how it evolves, right? Obviously, you've got an extra like 3-4 months age on the agave.
Yeah.
But that was about it.
Yeah. And side by side, you know, there's a lot of consistency, but there are some nuanced differences here on both the Blanco and the Repo. And, you know, what I love about this, and there's a lot of brands that have different lots, and we talk about different batches, and, you know, Ocho has really done a great job of getting you go, hey, this is a collector's item to want to say, hey, if we got a group of people together in 10 years, they could all go through and say, hey, my favorite was the 2022, the 2024. And that's a beautiful conversation to have. And especially to collect these and go, man, I'm really looking for one of these. But it is neat to see this is the field right next door, because, yeah, you know, it could be close in proximity, but who knows if that had beans right before it or corn planted in between, and all those things come into play with that soil composition that really does impact that flavor profile when you keep, because you guys are saying, hey, everything else is the same. We're going to keep the production process the same. We're going to keep the age for barrels the same. Now, barrels will change some things up over time with each fill. But for the most part, you know, you can come through and go, okay, there's similarities, but there's definitely some nuanced differences as you're sipping through. I just got the new ones. These are just starting to hit the market, so I haven't spent as much time with them. But what are some of those differences that you are starting to pick out?
So I describe things weird when it comes to like descriptors on taste and palate and things like that. So I always describe the Palo Verde as more round and the El Chiqueño is more angular. You know, for me, there's like a round sweetness that I get from Palo Verde, but with El Chiqueño, it's got more of kind of these like hard edges to it. It's a little bit more like, it's got more acidity. It's got a little bit more kind of pronounced kind of grassiness to it. Whereas like there was this like anise quality that I got almost every sip on Palo Verde, and that's much more subdued. It's almost more like there's still a little bit of that with the El Chiqueño, but it's more like fresh fennel rather than like star anise, if that makes sense. So it's you can tell it's like of the same family, but it's hitting closer to the grassy side of it rather than like the toasty baking spice world.
Yeah. Yeah. Both of these are great, from Blancos to the Reposados. And one thing I also want to draw attention to is price point. You guys, I assume this was deliberate. I mean, right now the tequila industry is in this weird spot to where brands that are coming out right now are really catching a little bit of this wave of one, you're not able to find some of these brands that you've been enjoying for the past couple of years, but two, you're seeing prices start to rise. And for you guys to go, hey, we're going to come out with a 46% Blanco and Repo, you know, we're at $55 to $65. It's pretty impressive. I mean, I've seen a few brands hit the market that they are good, but they're launching a $120 Blanco. And to me, and look, there's always a market for every price point. But for me, I go, I don't get that. I think you're trying to catch this wave. What was it in thinking for you guys to go, hey, we want this to be affordable for all and to hit something at 46 higher ABV is usually going to be a higher price point. But yeah. For the price, I've seen so many people online go, this is amazing. And I can't believe the price that we can continue to afford this. Was that deliberate? Is that just how it shook out? Or what was your thought process on that?
I mean, good, bad, or otherwise, we know what margins look like, right? Like, we've got enough other brands. We've done this long enough now that we kind of know what margins ought to look like. And we know, like, generally what we believe they ought to be for the quality of the thing, you know, but there's kind of like, you've got bumpers on it. You got to set boundaries for it, right? Because we could gouge, we could try and take a bunch more profit out of it. But realistically, when we run the numbers, you know, and when we can be creative about cost savings in other areas. So, for example, every time the field changes, we have to reprint labels. We have to reprint labels and case stickers, right? So there's additional startup cost. But if there is a way that we can design the labels so that the printing is less intrusive, yep. Right? So, for example, like the main label does not need to be changed every time. So we can run those in bulk, which is going to give us cost savings in the package. Also, the fact that we are actually able to find recycled glass at a time when the whole supply chain was locked up, they actually reached out and they were like, are you guys going to be okay with the fact that like there's going to be differences in coloration? There's going to be differences in bubbles. It's 100% recycled glass. And, you know, our conversation was like, well, the liquid is going to taste different every time. So why not let the bottle look different every time? You know, I mean, so it's little things like that, which fortunately we've just been in it long enough that it's kind of like we can find a few areas where it's like, we know we can create cost savings here that will then translate into, okay, we can keep the SRP approachable because frankly, it's a new brand. We want people to be able to find it. We want people yeah. to be able to like get into it and not feel like, oh man, I'm spending, you know, weeks of wages here. It's like, this is okay. I can try all this. I can get into it.
I mean, such an affordable price point for such an incredible tequila. I mean, congrats on this launch, this brand. Like I said before, people have been talking about this. People have been trying to figure this out on where to find this because it is incredible. And knowing there is a story here and it's also being made at one of the best distilleries that is currently producing tequila. You said you've got a few more that are going to launch. What can we expect in the future? And is there, you know, do you expect maybe two a year or how do you kind of plan for what you're going to harvest per year?
It's all going to be dependent on the field size, right? So those first two fields were quite a bit smaller than the third field, you know, but I think if we are able to see fields more similar to volume of what this third one will be, I would anticipate we'll see two, maybe three a year. And that's kind of, I think that's the angle that we're going to go. You know, we did flirt with the idea of possibly we're going to be sending down some of our used bourbon barrels.
Okay.
And also some of our used rye barrels. And, you know, part of this is that we don't want to use necessarily first fill for Lagrimas because, again, like the whole idea is terroir. We just don't want to overpower it. But, you know, if Chava wants to take on a project and, you know, season those a bit with some other tequilas, then, you know, we can evolve it over to Lagrimas as the time evolves, but you know, we'll kind of see how those turn out. I mean, I don't know that I've ever had a tequila aged in X rye barrel, you know, so I'm kind of curious to see what that does. I also, you know, we have access to some X Tokai barrels because we just finished a Tokai finish.
Okay.
We have X Madeira cask. And so, you know, there's conversations of it's very easy for us because we also own our own whiskey brand that like we have access to our own barrels and our own stocks that, you know, we can create some cool opportunities here. If we choose to do so in the future, I could see us maybe going down the route of a limited or like a specialty barrel reposado more so than an añejo. You know, I don't know that I would blend across a bunch of different barrels, but I might do like a one-off here as a reposado that aged only in Madeira cask or aged only in Tokai cask.
So. And you've got options for you guys to come together and say, hey, let's experiment. Let's play with this and let's see what it's going to come out. And Chava loves doing that stuff. And so for you guys to come together is pretty awesome. You know, as I said, the El Chiqueño is starting to hit markets. You did mention a third one. When roughly do you think we would maybe see that hit the market?
So El Sabino is the third, and the Plata is already distilled. The Reposado is aging. If I remember correctly, the Reposado hits 3 months on November 15th.
Okay.
So we are actually looking, though, to potentially bring up the Plata ahead of the Reposado if we can get labels and everything in order in time. Only because going into the holidays, the demand for El Chiqueño is so high right now, and we're about to run out of it again.
Yeah.
Because that's, you know, the nature of the beast at the moment. So the hope is to try and get some of the El Sabino Plata up here before, you know, ahead of the disgorgement of the Reposado.
And you guys, you doing all your own importing?
Yes. Yeah, we act as the importer. And
And how about distribution? Does it vary state to state or?
Vary state to state. So if you go on to altamarbrands.com, we do have our distributors tab that shows who our distributors are in every state. You know, and I always tell people the best thing you can do if you're trying to find a product is to go ask for it. Like, just go to the retailer.
Yeah.
And if you know the distributor and just say, hey, man, I know this is distributed by Winebow in California, any chance you can get it, that retailer going to Winebow and then coming back to us is the best route to market. Because inventory trackers and store trackers can be off, like, pretty significantly. So, you know, the technology's not quite caught up in the spirits industry yet. It's getting there every day. Some brands are better, like, have better access than others do. But I always encourage people, if you're looking for something, you know, check our website, see who the distributor is in your state, and then go ask for it. Otherwise, Curiata.com, they've listed the Palo Verde, and they actually just reached out before we hopped on the podcast because they confirmed that they're going to be listing the El Chiqueño here shortly as well. So they will have some of it. And I know that's an online resource. Passion Spirits has carried in the past. Old Town Tequila, I know, has carried it in the past. Yep. K&L. So, I mean, some of the bigger guys in some of the bigger states.
Well, Brandon, thank you. Thank you for all that you're doing with educating in the space, as well as continuing to find great brands that have a story to tell. I know you're very active on social media, lots of videos. You're using your digital marketing background, just creating great content as you are educating, not just in tequila, but the other spirits that you're very knowledgeable in. At Brandon.Altamar, if people want to follow you. And then I want to encourage people, go to altamarbrands.com. You can also find them on Instagram at Altamar Brands. Pick up some Lagrimas, but also look at their website and see what other spirits that they're behind and partnering with, because just by knowing what they're doing here, it's going to be some great whiskeys and gins and other spirits that you guys are working on. So Brandon, thank you for coming on the show. I want people to keep an eye out for Lagrimas, as that's going to continue to hit the market. But cheers and salute, my friend, and congrats on a bright future for this incredible tequila. Salute.
Amazing. Thanks, Doug.
See ya. That was Brandon Cummings with Lagrimas. Be sure to check out altamarbrands.com to learn more about the brand and their other spirits. A big thanks to SipTequila.com for sponsoring the show. Be sure to follow me on Instagram at Agave Social Club. I'm Doug Price, and thanks for listening.